Are you ready?
Okay, Smokey. Roll 'em. That's silly. Shoot him now! Shoot him now!
I gotcha!
Hello, everyone, and welcome to That's Not Quite All, Folks, a Lean Tunes podcast. I'm your host, Mark Hanlon, joined by...
And I'm Jordan Schmidt, and welcome to Let's List Again, like we did last December. That's right, it's our usual musical episode thing, where we do a bunch of musical Looney Tunes, most of which derive from Franz Liszt's Hungarian Dances. We've got two of those in here, plus an unconnected one that doesn't use Franz Liszt. And boy, are we raring to go.
Yes, we are. It's a continuation of our beloved musical shorts episodes, which are honestly one of our favorites. You try every time to get really, really funny Looney Tunes short musical episodes. And I think we picked three really good ones.
Oh my God, yeah. We have like a bunch of these. Here's basically where we're at. All three of these, I think, or at least two out of three of them, were considered for previous musical episodes. Like, because we've done so many of these, and we've done a lot of the obvious picks, and I think one of these was definitely slated for the last musical one and got cut and replaced with another one. And another one of these, I feel like, has been drafted for like three or four separate episodes by this point. All three of these are musical episodes we should have done by now, and we're doing them now, and there's, of course, it's going to be a really high-quality episode, because, like, we've only done, like, three or four musical episodes by this point, so, of course, they're still going to be good.
Yes, yeah, so the shorts we're covering today are Baton Bunny, Rhapsody in Rivets, ending with Back Alley Uproar.
Yeah, you're saying it like that because I think I put it in the notes as Back Alley Uproar, because that's what I thought the title was for years.
Yeah,
and
same.
When I Googled it, and I'm like, did you mean Back Alley Uproar? And I'm like, shit, I had it wrong. So
damn.
And I say I know so much. We're starting with the latest one of the three, which is odd. We're starting with the late 50s one, which is interesting. But considering which late 50s one it is, I think it's a good one to start with. This one is Baton Bunny, which was released on January 10th, 1959. All right, there's actually two really cool on this days. One is really cool if you're a me, and the other is really cool if you're, like, anyone, I think. So, Mark, if I were to say the name Fran Walsh, would that mean anything to you?
Fran Walsh. That sounds familiar.
Okay.
What do they do?
She is a New Zealand-based screenwriter, producer, and filmmaker. And what actually happened was is that she met her husband in the mid to late 80s. They've been married since 1987, so like 35 years by this point. And they are each other's writing partners. And they've co-written all their movies together. Because they started out as low-budget horror movie writers and directors. Her husband was a big, like, schlocky horror guy. And they slowly got to doing, like, more traditional films up until the point where her husband was offered the job to direct the Lord of the Rings movies. And so now she is Dame Fran Walsh, and her husband is Peter Jackson. And
they
have given gifts to... They are... Both of them in filmmaking history, I think, are the most... Not many married couples really survive when going into the film business together, because the process of writing and producing a film is a lot for someone that isn't married to somebody else. But they have stayed together ever since, and they have really helped each other's endeavors. Fran Walsh, I believe, has also been helpful on the many restoration projects that Peter Jackson has done with the Battleship. They Shall Not Grow Old documentary, and of course, the Get Back project. One of the most durable partnerships and writing duos in film history, and a legend in her own right, aside from her husband's directorial efforts. So I think that's a really cool one this day.
Yeah.
It's funny. I wouldn't have done that. I wouldn't have, like, it wouldn't have rung a bell for me if I hadn't just seen, there's a video essayist I like, I think Hats Off Entertainment, and he just did one on The Frighteners,
which is a very
underrated Peter Jackson film.
I love the guy's work.
The Frighteners is great. And he did a really good video on The Frighteners, and it mentions only Peter Jackson and his co-writer and partner, Fran Walsh. I'm like, huh, I'm storing that in the back of my head for later. And sure enough, she shows up here. So that's great. Yeah. Also, yes, The Frighteners, very underrated movie. I like it a lot. Also, another less cool, slightly less cool on this day that I've heard of, and Mark maybe probably hasn't, Kirk Kirkwood, guitarist, singer, and primary songwriter for the band The Meat Puppets, was born on this day. The Meat Puppets were one of Kurt Cobain's favorite bands, to the point where when Kurt Cobain basically said, hey, I listen to The Meat Puppets, they got a record deal and MTV airplay, and like, okay, we need to really chase the dragon of Kurt Cobain's influence. And they're all right. They're a cool stoner jam band kind of thing.
Listen, if I had that power and they're like, quick, what's your favorite things you like? We'll give it all the attention. I would just do it to mess with them. Like, oh, okay. Charles Manson. Love his work.
Well, you say that, but he kind of did, because one of the other bands that got the Cobain bump and a record deal and everything was the Butthole Surfers.
Oh, okay.
Because he said, hey, I really like the new single from the Butthole Surfers. And then the record labels came calling to a band called the Butthole Surfers, who would routinely commit sex acts in the middle of performances. Underrated band, too, but wild as fuck. So, yeah, it's the Cobain influence. And I think he was just a prankster. He was like, yeah. Let's get somebody to say butthole live on air, and that'll do it. So,
yeah.
But yeah, the Meat Puppets were pretty cool. The number one song in the U.S. was not as cool as the Meat Puppets. Well, maybe it is, depending on your sense of humor. It was the Chipmunk song, Christmas Don't Be Late, by Ross Bagdasarian under a couple of hot pitch filters.
Oh. Well, that's fun.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, is there anything more funnier, Jordan? Not just the Chipmunk. Anything more funnier than when a music act actually performs the Christmas song and they do it legitimately? Like, they present it like this big, normal, like, I think, who did, I think.
Christmas, Christmas. Yeah.
No, who did, I think Pentatonix did it. Like, some female artist. Okay. For their Christmas album went, I'm going to do a straight cover of the Christmas song by Alvin and the Chipmunks. I know this because they play it at my work.
Oh, dear.
No, but like, it sounds like any other Christmas song. So you wouldn't know it until you listen to me and go, on some rain that loops the loop. Oh, God damn it, it's a Christmas song. Yeah. Damn it.
It's one of those songs that like you have to at least have some fun with it. You know, or else it's, you know, it's because it's not exactly a champion of songwriting. It's like, okay, it's Alvin and the Chipmunks. You know, you got to enjoy it. But yeah, that was the number one song. That, because it was a novelty hit in 1958, Christmas 1958, and it turned into a whole thing that Ross Bagdasarian, oh, let's make them into full characters, give them more follow-up hits. And now they have an animated series. Yeah. Yada, yada. So.
Yeah. Well, wouldn't it be funny because Waters was tied with Stan Freberg. Wouldn't it be funny? It's just like, they're just, Stan's there at WB. It's like, and the number one song is The Christmas Song by Alvin the Chipmunk. Just Stan going, fucking bangus stash. Damn it, Ross. Fuck. I would actually effort into my parodies, unlike that sped up hack.
I fart in their general direction. All right.
Yes.
Baton Bunny was directed by Chuck Jones and Abe Levitow, story by Michael Maltese. This is a late 50s Chuck effort, and you can tell that because Abe Levitow is here. Also you can tell that because of the designs of Bugs and just the quality of some of the animation. I mean, the animation is still very good, but it's like it feels very late 50s.
Sorry. It's very Jonesian. Yes. It's very much like there's more lines that are shown in Bugs. There's more expression work put into Bugs' face during sex. You can go like, yes, I identify that as Chuck Jones, and also identify he's maybe trying a bit too hard. We love it, But he's maybe trying a bit too hard here.
Yeah, the stylization is when you know, okay, Chuck is maybe far removed from the reined-in quality of the Warner unit. It's when the Warner unit is becoming less of a thing and it's becoming less unified and they're really thinking more about, like, okay, what can we do now that we have these opportunities? So I think it's very interesting that this is a short with virtually no dialogue and yet Mel Blanc is still credited.
For what?
For one cough. Which is one thing you really want a guy with smoker's lung to do, is cough.
Huh.
All right, Mr. UTI guy, pee.
Joe Cocker? What are you doing here?
Joe Cocker had a UTI? All right. Joe, what does it feel like when, what does it feel like when you pee? I can't tell you, but I sure know it's mine.
So Mel Blanc is here to provide a cough. I wonder what that recording session was like. I really hope that they like they just like merge recording sessions. Like, okay, so Mel will pay a double. We're gonna record two shorts. Okay, here's this I don't know. Here's just like Daffy and Elmer short we're thinking of doing. Here's the script for that. Okay, and here's the script for Baton Bunny. Hands Mel one slip of paper.
Oh, okay.
Wow, that's a very thin script this time, guys. Okay, let's see here.
You think it's that? I honestly think what they did was they during like they're doing recording for another short, and then they go, okay, who wants a smoke break? And they just leave the recording studio on. They leave all the equipment on, and so you just hear it from outside. We got it. That's it. Print it. Say, why is that still on? Oh, no reason. Getting into it. I like the opening of this because the whole thing, it's about the Warner Brothers Philharmonic Symphony Orchestra kind of deal. And it's, you know, the Hollywood Bowl type thing. And I love it that they do like, okay, guest conductor ear spring up, Mr. Bugs Bunny. I love that.
And also, it's also a great introduction because, again, kind of going back to the Bugs Bunny at the symphony event that we went to a year ago now.
Yes.
This was the first short they showed. To be like, well, what's the best way to show? Well, here's a story. Bugs goes up on a conductor's desk and it says, guest conductor Bugs Bunny. It's like, well, that's probably the best way to introduce it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I have some other notes about from that going further into this. But I love that the first expression we see of Bugs when the lights come on, he's already tired. And it's very clear by 1959, and Chuck is very tired too. But, but yeah. It's like, okay, you know, very tired conductor. I'm glad that the coughing man, the one line of dialogue in this results in throw the bum out rather than Bugs shooting someone else.
And don't want to raise up the casualties, Doc.
No, not this late in a run. I also like, because again, this is very simple, subtle visual jokes in the beginning of this. I like the detail of Bugs sizing up a baton like he would a pool cue. That's very fun. And again, like, what's great about this entire cartoon is you have so many great shots of like the orchestra in great detail, and just like it's very similar to something like What's Opera Doc, or even Rabbit of Seville, where you just get these detailed shots and like they just shadow, and it looks really cool. Just the physicality of Bugs conducting. I remember, I'll bring this up when we saw the Philadelphia Orchestra do the Bugs Bunny of the Symphony. I remember George Doherty did the exact same starting pose as Bugs does, because he leaning into it, he's like, all right.
Yeah,
and then go right into it. And like a good solid minute of that is just Bugs just physicality and throwing himself over the place and just conducting with like his pinky toe. And it's not, I forget what piece it is, but it's not Hungarian Dance. It's the one here.
It's Vienna. It's like night, day, and evening in Vienna. So it's all down to good night.
You know, you win with Ringo. There were two possible jokes that I was going to go with.
Okay.
One is, Bugs, when will you realize? Vienna waits with you. So after some good physicality gags, it is 3 minutes into this cartoon, into the 6 minute and a half cartoon, that the true adversary, the fly, appears. And because that's the main hook of this, where it's like Bugs is trying to conduct. Well, things start going wrong. One of the things that go wrong is a fly lands on his nose and he's trying to flail his way off. And again, I love the orchestra going wild as Bugs flips in circles to try to get rid of the fly, just like double time. There's more of that as well. There's a bit here where Bugs loses his cuffs and like one winds up the other side. And it's pure Jones and done perfectly. There's not a lot of real concrete things for me to say about this one because it's all visual and it's all just time to music. And it just works really well.
The one bad I really like about this is when Bugs is really into the music to where like his whole body is like his tail is wagging. It's moving in time with the music. His ears are kind of conducting along with, and that's very nice. Very good animation.
Yeah. There's a lot of really cool, subtle animation things that really work here. But yeah, a lot of this is just very well paced. And there's one extended bit that sort of works. That, like, it's the sort of cowboys and Indians thing that Bugs does, where he's going back and forth and he's shooting arrows. And I don't think that's too racist, but it could be for some people.
It's all right. But also kind of, again, there's not really a story here. But the fact that, like, the entire time, Bugs is like, no. I can't fool around. I must conduct this music. And then it reaches this point, and Bugs is like, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to do Cowboys versus Indians for no reason.
Fine.
Okay. Sure, why not? Give into the music. He's in the music now. He's completely lost touch with reality. He's fully invested in the music. This is me that's conducting Cowboys versus Indian scene, and it's fun. You know, it's again there's a lot about this short. The animation is the main highlight. That's what really gets the jokes across. It's also what makes it fun, honestly, because like the music's really good.
Yeah,
and totally. The gag work is there, but it's really animation that's really doing a lot of the heavy lifting in this.
Absolutely, and at this stage, I think that Chuck is trying to. I think he's trying to make himself look good to other employers. Like, hey, look what I can animate. Look what my unit can do. I mean, he's basically compiling stuff for the resume at this point. There's not a ton for him left to do in 1959 at Warner. He's like, okay, how can I make myself look really good? All right, we'll do this one that's really cool and really cut to music. But I will say, the end of this, where the fly comes back and Bugs ruins the whole orchestra to try and get rid of it, is a very good ending. Where it's just like this thing's going wild. He's landing in drums and into the pit and things like that. And it's well timed to like the sort of disillusion of the track. And I like, and again, this ending reveal is also very indicative of this being 1959, where Bugs bows and there's no one left in the audience. Which, and the only person left to applaud is the fly. So basically, in this period, the Warner Brothers crew has gone from doing all of these filled auditoriums to now the audience is no longer there. The audience is now television. People aren't exactly camping out for they're not getting the money they used to. And the only people that they're doing them for is both themselves and the flies in the animation studio. So it's a very poignant ending. And a very, I mean, if you want to read it like that, I mean, there's probably other ways.
I really do think it's just a simple case of things go haywire. So everyone's like, well, this is ridiculous. I'm leaving. But I like that. I like your perspective way better.
Yeah.
Because it's
very. Why else would you have an ending where nobody shows up for Bugs Bunny, where everybody abandons Bugs Bunny? Because in the beginning, he is this big star. He's this, all right, you know, see Bugs Bunny in the orchestra and there's applause. And then by the end, everyone's abandoned. And that's, I think, where Chuck felt in that point. Where, okay, we're trying to do all these. Now we're trying to get outside producers. Now I'm getting co-directors. And now we're just like barely hanging on. And is anybody going to show up for Bugs Bunny anymore? And I mean, yes, that's not the only way to read this. It's probably more simple than that. That's just how I read it. And it's a really fascinating take on this this cartoon. But that said, it's a very good late era Jones Bugs cartoon. thrilling animation, excellent timing to music. I do feel like it was a bit unfocused and could have been a bit more with the fly rather than just like, okay, what can we do here? I think the fly was their hook and they should have really hit it a couple more times. This is still very good. I still prefer Rhapsody Rabbit, but this is still very good and it still does a lot correctly.
The star of this is not the gag work. It's certainly not the voice acting. It's definitely the animation. The Joan Jin is still able to provide good, fluid, funny animation, which something they wouldn't have access to in only like two or three short years. When you look at this, you look at Transylvania 65,000, there's been budgets cut in the last like year or two in between those two. But Rhapsody Rabbit is, I think, the more fun one. That's the one you want for the gags. The gags are much more stronger in that one. Oh, here it's very much like, it's a nice time killer. You know, it's like, hey, here's some really cool Bugs Out animation.
Yeah.
Isn't this great? And I'm like, yeah, it's good.
Yeah, it is. I give it a 4 out of 5. It's solid, but not to the heights of some of his other ones.
Same, I'm also giving it a 4 out of 5 animals. Next story we got here, which is also shown during the Bugs Bunny at the Symphony event. In fact, I believe that event was a reason this was put onto the dock, honestly, because
probably, oh,
it's
yeah.
Really, it's actually really good, which covers one, is Rhapsody in Rivets. It came out on December 6th, 1941.
The day before the day that will live in infamy.
Yeah. On this day, President Roosevelt wrote a personal appeal to Emperor... Oh my god, I cannot read this. All right. President Roosevelt wrote a personal appeal to Emperor Hirohito to avoid a war between the United States and Japan. Quote, developments are occurring in the Pacific area which threaten to deprive each of our nations and all humanity of the beneficial influence of the long peace between our two countries. These developments contain tragic possibilities. I address myself to your majesty, and that your majesty may, as I am doing, give thoughts in this definite emergency to ways of dispelling the dark clouds. I am confident that both of us, for the sake of the peoples, not only of our own great countries, but for the sake of humanity in neighboring territories. Stop in the name of humanity!
I'm warning you, with peace and love,
President Roosevelt as Wile E. Coyote. I'm telling you. I'm confident you may have a sacred duty to restore traditional amity and prevent further death and destruction in the world. And then the very next day, Pearl Harbor happens.
Yeah, it's like, oh, we're going... It's like, okay, we're going to just, you know, make sure that nobody else dies, and then the following day, bombs go off and people die. Pearl Harbor. What can you say about it? Not much. Anyway.
All I know is that Theodore Geisel may have had something to do with it.
Yes, exactly. What did Dr. Seuss know, and when did he know it?
Alright, so Rhapsody in Rivets was directed by Friz Freleng, written by Michael Maltese. Yeah, it's the short that came out the day before Pearl Harbor. That's about it. Also, this is Freeling in 1941, so it's in between this time, I think, for Freeling, where we're kind of moving out of the cartoon notion of just, oh my god, this thing's alive. Like, oh my god, look at this. Our car is alive. Oh, look at this. We made a pair of scissors dance. Isn't that amazing? And as you reach this cartoon, I feel this is a good segue between that tendency of cartoon filmmaking and character work. Because this short demonstrates both of them in a very well done way, as we'll get into.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So, there is no dialogue in this one. So, it's all gag focus, note taking. And so what this is it's a bunch of animals building the Empire State Building in New York City. It's led by a lion, because, you know, King of the Jungle and all that. He's the head conductor of this. When he even goes up on his little stage, there's New Yorkers from outside, like, applauding him, like, yeah! Go build that skyscraper!
By the way, what's important about when this came out is that this was around the time that the high-rises were going up in New York, and this was around the time where we were getting the tall buildings in major cities, and, you know, things were going upward. And this cartoon existing in 1941 is a very... It's basically a historical document, is what this is, because it's basically like, okay, how can we use the rise of the industry here and the rise of the business of tall buildings and industrial, I don't know if industrial revolution is the best term for this, but, you know, the rise of what we can do mechanically with building things, and how do we present that to the masses in a way that makes it seem cool and interesting. It's like, all right, we'll time a construction site like an orchestra, and that concept is fantastic. I have to say it with in all honesty, that is a wonderful concept, and the execution is just as good.
Yeah. So the song that they're performing it to, the Hungarian Rhapsody number 2. It's a very classic song. All the cartoon characters know it. And yes, pretty much what this is, it's a series of gags of animals doing construction work set to this song. And there's some good examples here that I like. There's one where as they cut to a piece where the cello is performing, there's a dog sawing a piece of wood, and it's set to the music, which I really liked.
That's great.
There's one moment where, and this is a kind of example of the, you know, oh, the things are alive sort of mentality of, it's a digger, right? I believe it's like he's digging up dirt. He has a boot on, so he's like a person. He's like, okay, throw all the dirt away. I'm like, that's a lot of fun.
There's a bit here because there's a callback, because there's the whole thing is when he's getting all the symphony together, there's one sleeping worker who misses his cue, and so after a while he just flings a brick at him. And so the second time that happens, where he does that stanza again, the sleeping worker, right when he's about to go on, just hits his cue, and you just see the conductor's ready to throw the brick and just sort of
as the brick, which I love. Yeah. I love that.
Also, I love the idea that movements of the symphony are instead blueprints of different floors. Instead of the first movement, there's the first floor and the second floor. That's really cool from a sheet music standpoint.
So it's around here we get kind of this late employee running to the site, and he's wearing a little green hat, and he has like a long face sort of. He's a small dog, and this it's
I
droopy.
I think he looked a little familiar.
It's droopy dog. It's absolutely...
You would think this would be the end of the game. But no, there's 5 more tantalizing hours.
It's a Game Grumps joke. I'm sorry. Whenever I think of somebody doing a droopy dog voice, I just think of Aaron and Dan doing their droopy impressions. But no!
Yeah, so you got this droopy dog-looking motherfucker. And I just couldn't help but think, like, just Tex Avery... seeing a multiplex going, hey, wait a minute.
Hey.
I could just change some things around. I could give those fuckers a piece of my mind.
Going, going.
It's fun to do, okay?
Yes.
Yeah. One of my favorite things they do is the little spikes in music at certain points. Like the one, the little cymbal spike when the dog realizes he's hammering an elevator attendant. That's great. And then the big one, because there's this whole sequence where just a whole bunch of people working on hammers and hammering nails. And there's a huge spike when they all hammer through and hit each other in the ass. It's great.
Yeah.
And then the tension of the elevator that's about to hit the dog. Did you also feel like, oh no. Oh no, how is it going to hit? That's going to be awful. And then it just sort of goes around it.
Goes around.
And then right into that, which means Fred has to get ready again. Every time. Every time. Freddy.
So this next bit here about the employee who wants to go up the ladder.
Oh, I love that one.
Ladder. Someone's walking down. Now, I gotta be honest, I wasn't a huge fan of it at first until the payoff.
Yes. Where you're
just like, screw this, goes all the way up, pushes people off, which, okay.
So good.
It's a cartoon. They all landed on nice big mattresses. They're okay. As just goes all the way up, goes into the elevator, and just shoots him all the way down back to where he was on the first floor. I'm like, that's fantastic.
That's that figures. And just like the wide shot of just the formation of the skyscraper going further and further up and around the clouds and higher and higher. I love all of those shots because it's progress. It's industrial progress. And it's being presented so awe-inspiringly. And it's like, you're supposed, like, as a viewer, even in the 40s, you're supposed to go, yeah, progress. And it just keeps going higher and higher. It's really cool the way they're just doing it to the music. And it's just,
it goes higher and higher and then left and then right. That got me.
I love that.
It's like, wow, keep going. And it goes, brush, brush, brush.
It's great.
Fantastic. So yeah. They keep building it. And eventually, as the conclusion of the In-Game Rhapsody comes in, the dog puts down the flag. This right gets revealed. It's called the Umpire State Building.
Perfect.
Everyone's applauding. They did it. Yay. As the droopy dog, not quite guy, opens a door, I think on the very top floor.
No, I think he closes the main door on the bottom. And then...
Oh, okay. Closes the door and then just starts crumbling down.
Yeah. Just the expressions that both the conductor and the dog has. Just the little sheepish expression the dog has as he's trying to get away from him. And then, of course, the comeuppance comes down on the
breaks the dot, dot, dot.
Yeah. Perfect. Funny ending.
Oh, man. So what I especially really like about this is not only is the animation really good, the music is also incredibly excellent, but I love this marriage in between of the old cartoon mentality and this newer cartoon mentality coming on, where I can identify, oh yeah, this bit with the specific dog was really funny. You couldn't probably even do that even 2 years ago around this point. And of course, just I don't know, man. Like, it felt of the one shot where it's a bunch of animals doing shtick. This one definitely felt more in line with what the Termite Terrence guys would do in the next 9 to 10 years.
Like, absolutely,
not too out of place with later Freeling and Jones efforts, especially with Maltese at the helm.
It's just so sharp. Like, pretty much every gag here hits in quick succession. So much is explored. The idea to find the artistic value in the very industrial business of building skyscrapers is fantastic. And I honestly think this is the most culturally significant Looney Tunes short of its era, in addition to being one of the best cut-to-music shorts ever made, because it's about this stage of history where things are changing and buildings are going up and things are, you know, things wouldn't be the same in New York City after this. And it would completely change the economy and how the city was seen as this beacon of big lights and things. And this is just the harbinger of that. Basically saying, yes, change is coming. Things are going up. But look at how good, look at how we can have fun with it. And look at how good it is. And it's really a defining moment of what the Looney Tunes crew could do. It's also just an immaculately animated, designed, timed short. And yeah, as you were, yeah, to bounce off what you were saying, basically the nth degree of the sort of animals doing things under a given theme short, and very much a leveling up of what they were able to do. So yes, I really enjoy this one.
Yeah, so anvil rating, I'm giving this a 4.5 out of 5 anvils.
And I am going to give it a 5 out of 5 anvils because I think it deserves it.
All right. Okay.
Yeah. And so we go on now to a short that I think I've waited 2 or 3 years to cover on this show. And I may not have known it until rewatching it for this. Back Alley Uproar, which was released on March 27, 1948. On this day, this is actually really cool, just 11 days after being released from prison, the singer Billie Holiday performs in front of a sold-out crowd at Carnegie Hall, which feels like it's probably the climax of the big movie they made about her all those years ago that I didn't see.
So, Jordan, please tell me you looked up why she was in prison 11 days previous.
I think it was for, like, racist reasons. Like, she did something kind of innocuous, and they were like, oh, because she's a black woman, she can't do that. Let's put her in jail. Ha, ha, ha. And then, of course, you know, it was like, oh, they're going to like me even more when I'm in there. I forget exactly what it was, but I think it's something like that. It's not, like, for something heinous. Like, she didn't, like, she didn't kill anybody, I don't think.
On May 16th, 1947... Holiday was arrested for possession of narcotics in her New York apartment. On May 27th, she was in court. It was called United States vs. Billie Holiday, and that's just the way it felt, she recalled. So, you know, they're doing this whole trial and everything. She got sentenced to a federal prison camp in West Virginia. And because of this, it caused her to lose her New York City cabaret card, which prevented her working anywhere that sold alcohol. Thereafter, she performed in concert venues and theaters, which, that's an upgrade, I think. Like, oh no, I can't perform these dive bars anymore. What's that? Carnegie Hall?
Wow. Yeah, that'll work.
That'll work.
Sure.
So she was released early. On March 16th, 1948, because of good behavior.
Yeah, and then the Carnegie Hall show.
Yeah. And apparently, her dog leaped up at Billie Holiday, which knocked off her hat and tackled her to the ground, because dogs are awesome.
Back Alley Uproar was directed by Friz Freleng, written by Michael Maltese and Ted Pierce. This is actually a loose remake of an earlier Freleng Porky short called Notes to You. This is also a rare cartoon where Sylvester actually wins because it's the combination that you don't see often at all of Sylvester and Elmer. Like, it's a very interesting, and thank God it works, but it's two characters that are usually paired with other characters and never really get to be paired with each other. And it's also just says a lot about how versatile of a character that Sylvester is. I've said that a million times on this show, that he's one of the most versatile characters. You can pair him with just about anybody. He can be a great foil in so many different ways. This cartoon is one of the many ways he can be a foil because he channels a character he almost like does a Daffy-esque sort of character in this. It could have been Daffy, but I'm glad it's Sylvester, honestly.
Yeah, because I think another reason why I probably chose Sylvester is that, you know, as everyone knows, Sylvester is the closest to Mel Blanc's speaking voice. That's the closest thing to his voice. Yes. So I think for this case, they're like, well, if we want to do a singing short, we should probably have it be someone that we don't have to speed up too much, that'd be easier for Mel to do. So we do have this one short where it's Arthur Q. Bryan doing Elmer, which that isn't too far removed from Arthur's voice either. So you kind of have this one instance of the two loony greats just kind of talking normal for once, or as normal as you can get with Sylvester and Elmer.
Or singing. Like, you know, he's breaking a sweat there, Mark.
Yeah.
Yeah, don't do anything too taxing, except sing. Sure.
Wow, this is much more than I did for Baton Bunny. Hey!
Yeah!
Smell ya, Chuck.
But yeah, no, this is... And also, I think that Sylvester would be make the most sense of being something that would keep Elmer awake outside his window, because Sylvester in this area is very much the alley cat, and this makes sense. So, yeah, no, of course. So, going into it, this is a very simple concept, because the whole thing is that Elmer, as per usual, wants West and Wee Waxation at West, and he... I like the little bit where he rushes into bed and tries to be asleep before the light bulb goes out. I like that. But the hook of this cartoon is Elmer is trying to sleep, and this is the exact moment where Sylvester, outside his window, decides to do all of his singing. Now, it's basically an exaggerated version of, and Mark, you can probably speak to this as well, of trying to sleep, but there's a dog outside your window or a cat or an animal that will not shut up. Like, if you live in a, in a neighborhood, you get something like that.
Yeah, that would happen sometimes where, like, I'll be sleeping, and it'll be, like, it's every minute. It's always at, like, 1 or 2 in the morning, and then my dogs just go crazy for no reason. And I'd be like, oh, fuck, okay. Gets up, goes, it's always at the back door, like, yeah, look at the back door. Oh, look at that, nobody's there. Stop it. Close it. Goes back upstairs.
Yeah, no, it's there's always something that's just amiss in the neighborhood that's always keeping you up. And this is the nth degree of that. It's like, okay, what if instead of it was just a dog howling, it's a cat doing a full
operatic performance.
Like a full performance, like a Billie Holiday performance. It's relatable enough, but they make it really silly. Because the whole thing, he just literally starts out with thick Caro, which is so silly. Of all people to break into Figaro, of course it's Sylvester who can't do the F's properly.
Figaro! 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 Figaro?
And I just love, just as he's performing it, and Elmer's throwing a bunch of stuff at him. I just love Sylvester Hines.
Figaro? Figaro? It just smiles when nothing's happened. All right. Figaro! Bam!
Perfect. Is this where we get the Thin Man joke?
It is, because there's Liszt again. There's another Hungarian Rhapsody thing. Hungarian Dances thing. I love this gag. This is such a good gag where you just see the Thin Man book on Elmer's desk. So he throws it at Sylvester, and Sylvester chucks it back, and it's now Return of the Thin Man. That's such a good joke.
Yeah.
That's why I love the Looney Crew in this, because they could do things like that. And I love the bit where he's in mid-song, and Elmer shuts the window on him. And then, of course, you hear the phone ring, and Elmer picks it up. Not again. I love whenever Elmer does this, where he just picks up and not even knowing that the gag is going to get it, just goes, hello! And he just goes, ah! Why is it that Elmer just going innocently, hello, is just always going to be funny to me? There was the one boxing, to duck or not to duck, where he's like, in this corner, Elmer Fudd, hello! Hooray!
Speaking of ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum,
yes.
I know the moment where Sylvester is, and he's singing, you know, Hungarian Rhapsody, and just, I just love how at this point Sylvester's just doing this. I feel like he knows he's annoying. He's like, you know what? Screw it. I'm going to fuck with Elmer in this one. Just goes,
tra-la-la-la-la-la-la-la. Tra-la-la-la-la-la-la-la. Tra-la-la-la-la-la-la-la.
It's extremely silly. And then there's this bit here where Elmer keeps setting traps for Sylvester and running into them. You know, just random, like, you know, just, okay, just trying to get up and down the stairs with grease on them, and then through the walkway with tacks on them and just going back and forth.
I love this so much because I love when Elmer's trying to go down the stairs, just Treg Brown put a bunch of, like, random sound effects as he's falling down. The sound department's having a field day with this. I love that.
Yes. No, everybody's like having... And even then, like, okay, we have this gag where, all right, Elmer is about to get Sylvester. Sylvester knows this. They're like, okay, fine. He passes off his music to another cat. And you think it's going to be some dumb cat that has, like, okay, duh, voice or something. But this cat has the voice of an angel and has this amazing female operatic voice that they just linger on for a good 30 seconds before Elmer finally whops him, and you just see the various faces.
I will say, it was this short that introduced me to the song, You Never Know Where You're Going Till You Get There, which is a good song.
I like that, too.
It's clear from like wartime, but it's like it's a really good song. And in fact, I would argue that this short is honestly, I don't believe the short is credited as a Merry Melody, right? If I'm not mistaken.
No, but it should have been.
It should have been. This is actually a really good demonstration, which, okay, obviously, Warren Burns is an old Hungarian Rhapsody number two, but it's a good music showcase of like older songs or current songs of that era. It's actually a really good representation for that. And also, I do love that when the operatic singer gets head, I just love they just pitch down.
It's great. Just the faces are great. There's an exchange here. Elmer kind of has Sylvester cornered. And there's actually dialogue in this one. And Sylvester says,
"Now just a minute, my fine feathered friend. Ain't you got no aesthetic sense? No ear for musical appreciation?
No, and I'm going to blow you to smithereens."
So Elmer gets violent against artists because he doesn't understand their art. Mark, I feel like you have a punchline for this one all ready to go.
All I can say is, I just know that Elmer would have more respect for the Looney Tunes than David Zaslav would.
Damn right, because he is one. Like, yeah, I have respect for myself. At least I think I do.
Anyway, even following the trajectory of our show the past couple of weeks, Kelly vs. Acme, look for it now.
Yes, please. Everybody. Last week we were really, really mad about it, and now we're a lot happier about it. So, I love this gag here where Sylvester lulls Elmer to sleep with a lullaby. And Elmer's like just trying to prevent against it. And it's very sweet where Sylvester just, you know, gets him to sleep and brings him back to bed. And we have silence. And the cut from Elmer finally sleeping soundly to the random brass attack of Sylvester with a drum and a big blaring brass instruments.
Sylvester's so good. One-man band.
I love the frantic sped up sounds of Sylvester running away with the trumpets and the drums. It's crazy.
And I just love the quickness of Sylvester leaves through the door. Elmer opens the door, slams into another
surprise.
Door, and just has a surprise.
That's a Bugs Bunny gag that made its way in there.
It absolutely is, but it's so funny.
Oh my god. The timing of Sylvester singing Angel in Disguise, of just the fluid motion of him. Going from the sweet singer to just going like setting off firecrackers and doing all these things. It's incredible. It's honestly, it's a great achievement.
You're just an angel in disguise.
It's so crazy. There's no reason for him to do that. At this point, he's really just fucking with Elmer. He doesn't care if the performance is. He's just doing this to piss off Elmer. To the point where Elmer just goes full Wile E. Coyote, speaking of, and just lights up dynamite as we get this explosion as we then cut to heaven. And Elmer is just on the cloud in heaven. He's like, finally, rest and relaxation at last. Oh, buddy.
And then all nine of Sylvester's lives come crashing down on him, singing. And it's because again, you see just like coming past the camera and just like down, and it's a really, really, really good shot. And of course, Elmer just jumps off and catapults himself to hell, probably. I think you should go first.
Yeah, so this is a, you know, it's so funny because like we go like, oh, but Tom Bunny, really good animation, the gag work could be better. We go over to Rhapsody and Ribbit, where it's like, oh, the animation's good, the gag works are also pretty solid. I do like how that when we get to back like Uproar, it's like It's like the best of everything. There's really good animation in certain sections. There's amazing music gag work, great character work. I love character work in these cartoons, and especially in this one. Fantastic character work. I don't have any nickname notes here. In fact, the one thing that we forgot to mention is Sylvester sings Moonlight Bay by himself.
Oh, yeah! Yeah!
And I love that when he's doing it, he's doing, like, sound effects.
We were sailing along, we were sailing along, on a moonlight bay, on a moonlight bay. We could hear the voices ringing, clang, clang, they seem to say, the loving voices seem to say, you have taken my heart, you have taken my heart.
Kitty, 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 kitty.
Mel does a fantastic job in this, of course, and as is Uncle Brian. It's just, it's a solid Looney Tunes short, man. Solid.
Yeah. I don't think there is anything wrong with this one. It's a perfect setup. Every gag works. Elmer and Sylvester work against each other perfectly. It's an excellent escalation. The music is used excellently as a great ending. There's so many different types of gags they're able to fit in here, and they all work. It's a versatile, they're just showing off after a while. It's like, okay, they can do this too. And then this animation happens and this, and it feels like everything they're trying to do works. This is a classic right here. And perhaps the greatest show of Sylvester's versatility of any of them. I think this, I'm glad they went with Sylvester in this one because I love that it's him. And I love this is one where he wins. Sylvester wins in this one. That never happens.
No. Oh. All right, I'm giving this short. No surprise here, really. I'm giving this short 5 out of 5 animals.
That is exactly what I'm giving it, because I think it deserves a 5 out of 5. I think this is an immaculate short. I am glad we finally got it.
It's a great blend of everything that they were able to accomplish, and I love it so much. All right, let's see what you guys had to say about these pretty damn good musical shorts.
All right, so we have Mario Bendor at Bendor Clips says, I don't know which one is considered to be the best, but I think out of every short that parodied Fantasia, Rhapsody and Ribbits is the best. According to Concerto, is funnier to me, but it's missing. Rhapsody and Ribbits is super satisfying timing. I'm kind of with you on there. I didn't really know that it was really trying to do Fantasia. I think that it's more just like a symphony kind of thing. If you want to call it a Fantasia one, amazing. Yeah, I guess that does count. I do think it is better than Corny Concerto by a hair. Just because I love what that does with timing the music and also just the concepts it works with. I sung the praises of that cartoon all throughout this episode. It does stack up to something like Corny Concerto and also Pigs in a Polka in a way.
Yeah, it definitely would fit in within that. If you were to drop that within a Corny Concerto, I think it would actually fit in pretty well. We also have a comment here over on the Instagram from the Pemmy and James pod, so probably through James Irish. It says that when picking cartoons for our Sylvester-centric podcast in 2021, so examples like cartoons with the cat but without Tweety or Speedy, Back Alley Uproar was number one with a bullet. It's a magnificent bridge between the sensibilities of the 40s and 50s eras of Termite Terrence and a tour de force of gags both played straight and subverted. It's a top 10 cartoon for me on a personal level, and my second favorite Sylvester one with only Birds Anonymous ranking higher. There's really not much more I can say that I'm sure you two gentlemen haven't said earlier in this very episode. Well, thank you very much, James. Yes, please. Thank you. Yeah, I mean, it's real. I would argue to say this is probably Sylvester's best without Tweety cartoon in some respects. It's like that and like Scary Paws, you know, in regards to like really good uses of Sylvester outside of the Tweety dynamic. So thank you so much for your comments, everybody.
Before we get to what we're doing next week, we just want to take this opportunity to thank the people that have subscribed to our Patreon. People such as TriScrew, Andrew, James Irish, Sam Adams, the guy, not the drink. They have helped us out by pledging anywhere from $1 to $5 on our Patreon, and they get perks like being thanked in the middle of an episode in addition to their commentaries that they get that we record, as well as early access to episodes and handwritten letters from me and also playbacks of live streams. So if you want to become a patron just like those four that I thanked in the middle of this episode, you can follow our patron at patreon.com/TNQAF.
That was fun watching three cartoons you really enjoy. We know are really good because next week.
Oh, no.
We are now in December, folks.
Oh, no.
And that only means one thing. Once again, it is time for That's Truly Quite Awful, folks. Three shorts.
Yay.
That both of us don't like. Or we know, or we think is bad, or what have you. Previous shorts included Old Glory, controversially the Dover Boys, but don't worry, we really liked that one.
We came around. You came around on that one. I did.
As well as
Bugs' Bonnets was in there.
Bugs' Bonnets, yeah.
I think How Haunting We Will Go is it? No, I think that was another one.
But yeah, these are shorts that are either not good, or we're like, hey, that's probably not a really good one. Let's not cover it. So the ones we are covering this year are Catnip College.
One I don't like, yeah.
Curtain Razor.
Yes.
Ending with Hair Breath Hurry, a Wile E. Coyote cartoon.
Oh, boy.
Huh. Good timing there, buddy. Finally got the damn movie back, and we're going to talk about
it. Well, if it hadn't come out, this would have been us putting out our frustrations at not only WB, but WB in 1962 or 63 when that came out. Because I'm going to just make a bold prediction. That one is going to piss us off.
Okay.
I could be wrong. I've been wrong before. I think that one's going to piss us off.
Okay. I don't know why.
You don't know what the deal is with that one?
I know it's a Bugs and Wile E. cartoon. That's about it.
You're not ready. You have a week to get ready. You're not ready, but you will be. Oh, yes, you will be.
But rest assured, the rest of the year looks pretty good. We got some pretty fun ones to wrap the year up on. So,
oh my god, there's some I'm very excited for to end the year. Of which we've already done some recording for, and we think you guys are really going to enjoy.
Oh yes. All right. So that is the end of this week's show. If you want to follow us on Twitter, you can follow me at MarkHallam1995,
and you can follow me at TallGuySchmidt.
If like you came up with the podcast or gave your thoughts for next week's episode, you can follow us at @that_loony, both on Twitter and Instagram, or type in the podcast title. We are the first results.
You can also find our podcasts wherever podcasts are readily available. That includes your Apple Podcasts, Spotify Podcasts, Player FM, Amazon Music. We have a YouTube channel where we post clips from our episodes. We update that pretty regularly. We also have YouTube Shorts on there. We also have a TikTok account for some reason. Follow us there. We post short-form videos there. And if you like what you've been hearing from us and want to get it in time as we've sort of discounted our items, you can follow us on Patreon at www.patreon.com/TNQAF.
Yes. That's a good reminder, Jordan. So for next month, we are doing a large discount on all of our Patreon stuff. So everything on our Patreon is going to be for $1. So give our Dental Girl Books Patreon, you get everything that we've done throughout the years. So that's what, like 11 commentaries, exclusive videos, our full recording session with Bob Bergen's on there. There's a lot of really cool stuff.
We guarantee you'll really like it.
All right. So until next week, I'm Mark.
And I'm Jordan. We're going to conclude this episode like we began this recording session, with us arguing with each other with the sound off. Good night.